Thank you all for standing by. Welcome to today's conference call. At this time, all lines are on listen only for today's conference until the question and answer portion of our call, at which time you will be prompted to press star one on your touch-tone phone. Please be sure to unmute your phone line, and please be sure to record your name when prompted so that I may introduce you to ask your question. Our conference is also being recorded, and if you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn our conference over to our hosts, Ms. Andrea Robles and Joseph Bream with the Corporation for National and Community Service. You may proceed at any time.
Thank you. Thanks, Jill. Thanks, everyone, for joining us to our second Research and Evidence webinar. As an office, our objectives are to build knowledge on civic engagement, volunteering, and national service by funding research and supporting our programs and their grantees. And we strive to share and use our research findings in several ways. We post our research reports on our Evidence Exchange webpage. We have an annual research summit, a quarterly newsletter, and other ways, mostly through our website. Our new webinar series is another way to share our cutting-edge research conducted by grantees or in collaboration with our research partners and contractors. In our pursuit of knowledge building, we hold a research competition for institutions of higher education, which is available to scholars or researchers of any type and dissertators. Our first research grant competition was held in 2015, and we awarded 7 grants. Today's presenters, are one of our 2015 National Service and Civic Engagement Research Competition awardees. A few weeks ago, we released our notice of funding availability for our 2017 research competition, which is also available to scholars and dissertators at institutions of higher education, and the due date is July 11th. So hopefully you've received an email with the announcement, and if not, please just send us an email. We understand that research needs to be understood in order for it to be used. In these webinars, we hope to be able to appeal to various users, including scholars and practitioners. And although this is exciting for us, we know that it's difficult to meet the needs of both. So if you can please just send in any questions you may have through the chat box or wait for the Q&A, and we'll answer any questions that come our way. So before I introduce our speakers, I'm just going to turn it over to Joey and see if there's any housekeeping details.
Hi, everyone. This is Joey Breams, also from CNCS. Fortunately, we have Jill on the line taking care of us mostly, so I don't think we have too many housekeeping details to attend to at the moment. One thing to note, we will, or as Jill mentioned, we are recording this call, and that will be posted online after the presentation. So please make sure that you have RCP so we can give you a notification when that does go up. Something else to note, if you are on the visual portion, there is a chat box. So we will be accepting questions either via the chat box during the Q&A period or over the line. Either way should work. We will try to get to every question if we can. Apologies if we're unable to, but we will do our best. Otherwise, I will be kind of working in the background to try to handle any TA issues. So if you're running into something, you can also use the chat box for that as well, and I will try to assist you.
So for those of you who signed in to our first webinar, thank you for your patience. I know we had some issues with call, so we hope this one's going to go smoother. So today we're pleased to welcome Professors Amy Best, John Dale, Jim Witte, and Shannon Davis, and a few of their team members, Katie Kerstetter and Samantha Retrosi from George Mason University's Institute of Immigration Research. This is a mixed method study. So in year one, the focus was on conducting quantitative analysis of immigrants in 6 cities, and the work was led by Jim Witte and Shannon Davis. The results from year one was presented in our research summit, and there will be more analysis and findings forthcoming. But today's webinar focuses on the research from year two that focused on the qualitative component, and that's led by Amy Best and John Dale. However, all the PIs and team members are here and willing to answer questions. So right now I'm just going to introduce Amy Best, who will then pass it on or introduce her team members.
Yeah, so I'll get us started. Hi, it's great to be here. So the four of us, John Dale, Katie Kerstetter, myself, and Samantha Retrosi, will be presenting the qualitative portion of the work. We're also theologists, Katie is a research affiliate with the center in IIR. She's a recent PhD from our program and is a former VISTA member. John and I are both professors in the Department of Sociology. We both do qualitative research. And Sam is a doctoral student in our graduate program, and she also does qualitative research. So, and then Shannon Davis and Jim Witte, who are available to answer any questions in the Q&A, are quantitative researchers, and Jim is the director of the Institute for Immigration Research, also sociologist. So I'm going to move on to the presentation. Today, really what we're looking to do is talk about the qualitative research and what is an emerging conceptual framework for linking professional success and civic engagement among immigrant professionals. Most of the time, when we think about the benefits of qualitative research, we think about it in terms of putting a face to numbers. But the more significant strength of qualitative research is that it enables us to build conceptual scaffolding and to identify mechanisms, cultural and institutional mechanisms, and in this case, focused on how professional success and civic engagement are linked. And the reason why that is qualitative research really enables us to hone in on sort of the very messy, complex, dynamic processes that make up everyday life. So we have several different research questions, but just in brief, we were interested in understanding how immigrant professionals think about civic engagement, the kind of civic engagement they engage. We were interested in looking at the ways in which professional success and civic engagement were linked. And then the role that cities play in shaping that particular arrangement. So those were sort of the guiding questions. And as Andrea said, this is part of a much larger mixed method study. We drew our sample largely from the 4,000 immigrants who had completed the survey that Shannon and Jim had undertaken. And so we have 70 in-depth interviews. They're all with immigrant professionals. And this group represents the range of professional work undertaken, and they live in both small cities and large cities. We thought we were going to begin with these seven large cities to find that, in fact, this population is a highly mobile population, and they aren't necessarily anchored in one city. So just a little bit on methods. We think about these interviews as cases. And so we've been guided by a logic of case study, and what that's meant for us is that sampling has been directed by an interest in sampling for range, that the interviewing has proceeded sequentially. And what that means is that insights from one interview then informs how the next interview goes, and that we privileged saturation over representativeness as we built our sample. And what that means is you've reached saturation when you stop uncovering new things. So and for us, I mean, the first 50 interviews really were, we continued to learn new ways in which professional success and civic engagement were connected. So we've done 70 interviews to date. We expect that we will conclude at 75, and in large part because we're not really learning anything new. So we are sort of moving toward saturation. So we then, after we've collected our interviews, we're still transcribing some of them, but engaged in systematic coding, and this involved both open coding, which is a sort of casting your net broadly, line-by-line coding, entertaining all possibilities, and then more focused coding, where you actively look for what are agreed upon emerging themes. And what we did is, because we're a team of four, we wanted to ensure that we would have some level of intercoder reliability. And so all four of us decided that we would code the first five interviews that we had. We selected those interviews because of their range. And then we're just over 50 now that we've coded. But we decided to have at least two people code those next 50 interviews. And we used in qualitative in vivo software, which is a wonderful mechanism, not necessarily for identifying thematic content. You have to do that yourself. But what is very valuable about it is that you can develop a very complex code book. You can have multiple researchers. You can actually look for measures of intercoder reliability to see if are we coding it in a similar kind of way. And then you can run some very cool queries that look at the relationship between attributes and some of the code. So you can see on the strategies for analysis, this is just a sort of a sampling of our code book. We have, probably 50-plus codes and then subcodes for each of these. But these were some of the things that emerged from us from our reading through and coding encoding the interviews. What we found, we had agreed that we were going to do interviews with folks who, by all accounts, are professionally successful, and by any objective measure, they are. By any objective measure, they are. They're educated. They have held or are in the process of moving toward employment in the professional labor market. Some were in professional labor markets prior to migration, and then the kind of work that they do looks a little different post-migration. And what we found is that in looking at this notion of professional success, that in fact it's sort of exists on a continuum. And so we conceptualize professional success in terms of professional pathways, and we attempt to map the movement along that pathway. So for the interview participants, some are were at the very early end of their professional lives, so we identified them as emerging. Others were sort of starting over because maybe their credentials didn't transfer or the small business model that they had in their prior home country didn't quite work in a U.S. context. Some were midstream, so they were very much mid-career, and others had fully arrived. And so these are sort of our effort to conceptualize what civic engagement and professional success looks like for folks who are at different, really at different points, nodal points in their careers. And we think about the pathways in these processual terms, so it's about the process. And what we found is that for some, though they were on a straight path, that for a lot of them it was full of detours, sometimes dead ends, lots of go-arounds, and for lots of them, fits and starts, so that they sort of began the career and then stopped and then began again. One interview that we conducted, the participant had come over to the U.S. to study her master's. She came on a government fellowship. She had her master's in library science. The condition of the fellowship was she had to return to her home country, which is Georgia. She did so. She expected to return to the U.S., only to find that she really actually couldn't find work and then ended up going back to Georgia, but then was able to return again because she found that she had another government fellowship. She was able to have a series of internships along the way. So it sort of felt like she was going to have the career, but it didn't quite materialize. And so she was our first person we interviewed, and she resides in Georgia and, in fact, doesn't quite use the work that she's doing in library science. She does work with research centers that are sort of linguistically oriented and then also government, but she does translation work. And so hers was sort of this fits and starts. So our slide is frozen, but we're moving forward.
Sorry about that. We had a bit of a drop off, but I think.
Well, I'm going to move forward. So in terms of civic engagement, when we conducted the interviews, we did not have an existing definition of what civic engagement was. Again, we were interested in how they were defining civic engagement. And so we did cast our net pretty broadly. We used community involvement and civic engagement more or less interchangeably in the interviews. But this is sort of a working definition that the team as a whole has been, the team of six plus. Has been using to think about civic engagement. And what we found is that the participants are variously engaged. I mean, I would say that their participation or civic participation is quite high, and it enormously varied. We generally found, just in a nutshell, before we moved to sort of the linkages between professional success and civic engagement, that civic engagement was often tied to their professional and vocational interests.
How about this?
It's okay. I'm just going to keep talking.
There we go.
I think we're on to the next slide. So that they were variously engaged. It was mostly tied to their professional and vocational interests. We generally found that it was difficult to disentangle their professional networks, their professional pathways from their civic work, and in fact, their community ties as well. So there was a lot of movement back and forth. And in terms of the types of participation, I mean, they participated in formal organizations. None had participated in any national service programs, which we thought was interesting, even though they were variously engaged in professional organizations, community arts projects, religious organizations, gave service to their local governments, their children's schools, fire departments, that the work was both local and translocal, so they often worked for either community-based organizations or, in some cases, large cross-state organizations that served immigrants, for example, as just one case. And in some cases, we found that folks were participating in what we would call transnational civic engagement. Some had worked in nonprofits, some had started nonprofits, and others had volunteered in them. This is our conceptual map. I'm going to hand things over to Katie, but this is the conceptual map that really is intended to simply give you a sense of the dynamic way in which these different sorts of processes are intersecting with each other. So there's a sampling of our codes that sort of run the perimeter, and what we're finding is that the arrows are bidirectional. So let me turn it over to Katie.
Yeah, so just to continue, we see our two main areas of interest in the center, civic engagement and professional success, and then some of the codes and the themes that are emerging through this qualitative analysis that we're doing around the periphery. So you can see how, you know, characteristics like transnational mobility and immigration policy are both connected to each other and also connected to these two key areas of interest in the center. And as we continue with this work, we're going to continue to flesh out these connections. And for this presentation, we're going to hone in specifically on the two in the middle, the relationship between civic engagement and professional success. And Amy, you can go ahead. Yeah. And so we're doing that through a topology, so I'll give you a moment just to take a look at these seven key themes that are emerging at this point in our analysis. So we're going to take some time now to flesh this out a little more. I'll start with the first few, and then John's going to take a couple. And so if we take a look at the first one, we're noticing that for some cases, some individuals that we spoke with, professional success and civic engagement are linked strategically. And for us, that means that civic engagement in these individuals' lives are serving professional ends. And we have two examples of this, one individual that's just starting out in her career and another one that is restarting her career in midlife. So in one of our cases, Fiona, and all of these names are pseudonyms, just to let you know, she's a college student from Rwanda, and she's studying for a BA in international finance at a university in North Carolina. And so within this university, Fiona's engaged in lots of civic engagement that's tied directly to her professional aspirations. So she volunteers for Habitat for Humanity, but she volunteers to help them with their accounting. So she's doing a specific skill within a nonprofit that's tied to the degree that she's aspiring to. She's also done volunteer work at internships that she's done within financial corporations, and she's also done a lot of volunteering within professional associations, so like student financial and accounting associations. She's done volunteer work for that. And the volunteer work that she's done within those sort of institutions have really helped her to gain scholarships, gain admission to honor societies, gain additional internships. So she's sort of used civic engagement to hone her professional skills and then to gain additional opportunities that allow her to advance in her professional career. And so that's our sort of beginning career example. And then we have another case, Carmen from Mexico. She's restarting her career after leaving an abusive relationship. So she's really starting from scratch here. And so she's working at a bank, and she participates in all the volunteer activity organized by her bank because she sees that as a really great professional networking opportunity. So she's engaged in corporate civic engagement as a way to move up and restart her career in midlife. And so in both of these cases, both Fiona and Carmen recognize the value of professional networking and see civic engagement as a way they can help to advance their professional careers. And so that's our first theme in this topology that we're continuing to build as we continue our analysis. But turning to the second theme here, we saw that professional success and civic engagement overlap, but that civic engagement is not being used strategically for professional advancement. Instead, someone's taking their professional skills and using them for a social good that's not tied to their interest in advancing their career. And so our example here is a gentleman named Andrei from Bulgaria. And so he's a software engineer who's active in the open source community. And so he's creating software that can be shared freely with people rather than people have to pay sometimes large sums to access. And so he defines the open source community as a global community working on shared problems, that he feels connected to this community. And he believes strongly that computer software should be free, and he uses the professional skills that he's gained as a software engineer and developer to improve open source products so that more people have access to software. He also has a personal blog he maintains to sort of share his professional expertise with people on his own free time. So he's not being paid for the blog. It's not advancing his work within his company, but he is engaging in work that helps other people to access a resource that he considers to be a social good. So they're increasing access to computer software. So we see that as a little more distinct from the first topology in which people were using their civic engagement very strategically within their workplace and their educational institutions. And then so transitioning now to the third theme, we also found individuals and cases for whom professional success and civic engagement are actually one and the same. And so for these individuals, professional work serves the social good and often involves working in nonprofits or the non-governmental sphere. So the actual professional work that they're doing is a form of civic engagement. And so for an example there, we had the case of Anjali, who's from the Dominican Republic. And so she was trained as a doctor in the DR before she came to the U.S. And her medical credentials, luckily, from the DR had some transferability, so she was able to come here and then work in a hospital in the U.S., which wasn't always the case for people that we spoke with. However, her experience in the hospital in New Jersey was very alienating. So there was little diversity there, so she didn't feel so connected to people she was working with and also to the practices in the hospital, which felt very different than what she was familiar with in the Dominican Republic. However, she'd also done some volunteering over 3 to 4 years in rural medical clinics in the DR before she came to the U.S. and had a real passion for using her medical expertise to help other people. So what she decided to do is to step away from sort of a strict medical career to look at, like, global public health. And so now she's doing a master's degree in global health at Montclair State, and she wants to work to implement effective global health policy so that her career would literally be her civic engagement. And then I'll turn it over to John, who's going to talk about a couple more elements of our typology.
Thank you, Katie. I want to begin by reiterating that this is not an exhaustive typology. This is still under development, and I won't go through all of the remaining ones, but there are a couple more I think worth highlighting. The first is civic engagement and the way that it spurs professional success. And by spurring professional success, we also include cases like the one I'll present, Jose, where you see a sort of spiraling effect throughout his life. These really do kind of reinforce each other. Jose came to the United States from Cuba as a boy in the 1960s, and he didn't do well in school in Miami, and I was surprised to learn that Miami did not have a very large Hispanic population that far back, and when he first came, he felt some of this discrimination early on. He decided to join the U.S. Army, and after serving a while, he developed mechanical skills, and he'd also worked a bit as a paramedic. When he got out, he decided he'd start working on cars. He did that for several years. Then he started to feel maybe he was getting his hands too dirty, and he looked into signing up with the Army again, but this time applied to Officer's Candidate School and was successful and served another 20 years in 1 month, as he said, so he was qualifying for retirement. He served in the Persian Gulf War, the Desert Storm, did some service in Korea, and Throughout his career, he was able to travel throughout the world. He says he's been to about 23 to 24 countries. Not all of it was just working in the Army. Some of it was his own interest. And one of the places he was stationed in the Defense Intelligence Agency in Virginia. He was living in Dale City, and he had a friend there who was a firefighter, and in Arlington, and he encouraged him to sign up as a volunteer, and he thought that sounded pretty interesting. So he checked it out, and they didn't have firefighting classes per se, but they did have EMT classes, emergency medical training classes. So he decided he'd go ahead and take them, and he ended up working his way up to an EMS lieutenant position in the as a firefighter. That experience then caught the attention of other people he knew in Massachusetts, and he was hired in Cape Cod as a fireman later on. He's now out of the Army, and he's an assistant director of emergency medical services there. And this sort of was made possible not only by this volunteer service, but also his paramedic experience in the Army. When he was in Cape Cod, though, he continued looking for ways to engage civically, and an opportunity quickly arose because there was a water pollution problem there. And he had enough experience in the Army to see that this was there were some ways they could solve this. And he went to the local community board, and they started figuring out ways to work on this. And he was held up as a hero and eventually elected to office working on the board and served in many positions on the council. I mean, this is a very heroic figure, and I'm only catching the tail end of this. The story goes on and on. It's amazing. But, so that's one example. The next one I want to talk about is how civic engagement satisfies existing professional goals and interests, but especially when credentials block professional pursuits. It can be for lack of ability to transfer credentials. This is actually one of the most substantial obstacles to professional success. Often this leads to returning to school or possibly deciding to change professions, but it can also spur civic engagement. Raj from India, who's 55, has a law degree from India. She also had another degree in business accounting, but she was unable to transfer her credentials to the United States to pursue legal education through employer-sponsored education program with Boeing. But she worked as an administrative officer for him for them in her free time. That's how she started. She worked extensively. I'm sorry, worked for Boeing full time, but in her spare time. Volunteers with local law enforcement and public safety services. This actually began much earlier in her life. When she first moved here, she was unable to work initially. She moved over with Microsoft with her husband. Her husband divorced her. He was now moving back to India for Microsoft. Originally, he was coming to the United States. So she was taking care of not only her three kids, but her sister, who subsequently moved in with two kids, and all of them together. And in India, she pointed out that when you are working for a company, that's where community and civic engagement begin, and it's usually with other families that are also employed by that company. But in this case, in India, there was an enclave that she could have been a part of, but because she wasn't married, she was unable to participate and make connections in that way. On the other hand, in India, when you take your kids to school, you're locked out, and she felt you let the kids go and you're not a part of their lives. But here, she found that she was able to volunteer in the schools, and she started to do that, and most of her social networks were largely through her children. But that volunteering in the school started to lead to interesting opportunities for her. And one day, the children were kidnapped, and not her children, some of her children's friends. And that's how she began this interest in serving with local public law enforcement, mostly helping children who had been disappeared. So this had a sort of long career, but after she started working in bigger offices of law enforcement, she also became a volunteer member of the Kirkland Fire Corps, where she administers first aid and CPR training. And she's a volunteer of domestic abuse response teams in the Kirkland Police Department, and also volunteers with the King County Sheriff's Office, where she assists with search and rescue missions. So in essence, even though Raj's interest in pursuing a legal career in the U.S. was blocked, she's been able to pursue her interest in law enforcement and public safety through her extensive civic engagement activities. Now, we're also, I think we have the next slide. Yeah. We're also interested in barriers to civic engagement. Some of the most common have been around parenting and other household obligations, we found. Several cases suggest that limited time for civic engagement is due to parenting commitments and household obligations. That's not unusual, even for professionals who are not immigrants, we know. And parenting's facilitated particular forms of civic engagement, such as I mentioned, with Raj, involvement in children's schools. But it's also inhibited some forms of civic engagement, like volunteering for nonprofits or serving on nonprofit boards that require evening meetings. And this barrier, we should point out, was most commonly experienced by women. Ella, for instance, from Columbia, who's 56 years of age, had degrees in engineering and business. She works at IBM in Boston, and she came to attend college in the United States. She got involved in volunteering at her children's school when they were younger, and now that her children are older, she volunteers for a nonprofit because it has more flexibility and she can attend the evening meeting. So we sort of think this is, she had an interest in participating all along, but didn't have an opportunity to do it because of these barriers. And we find that exists quite a bit across our samples. So we could go on with many examples like this. I also want to mention a little bit about the role of cities. And I think we have a slide for this.
We can go back to it during the Q&A that week.
Yeah. Let me make sure I've got my slide. So, you know, in our quantitative study, as we began, we were looking at surveys across seven cities. And now in the qualitative part of this research, we're finding that cities are experienced a little bit differently by these professional immigrants than probably the way we were imagining it as we were developing the survey. The urban experience of professional immigrants in the United States is grounded in the sense of community developed through their interaction with people. Interactions with people in urban institutions and organizations, schools, workplaces, voluntary associations, internet-based meetup groups, and many others. Community in this sense is not well represented by cities' contiguously bounded territorial space, like you might see on a map, nor their boundaries of municipal jurisdiction. Rather, they're better understood as network spaces, not spaces as physical containers of interaction between immigrants and their contacts, but rather formal and informal networks of relations that produce social spaces of community. One of our most important preliminary findings in our research with regard to the role that cities play in shaping civic engagement among professional immigrants is that these networks are translocal, linking multiple cities within the United States, and indeed even transnational, linking cities across the nation-state boundaries and the institutions of governance that shape the flows of cultural identity and power that sustain and alter those boundaries. Many of these immigrants have a strong sense of commitment to cities, but not necessarily to any one city. They pitch a tent of relationships, projects, and survival in spaces staked in multiple cities, and we call this transnational urbanism. I think at this point, given the time we have left, I'd like to have Sam Retrosi pose some questions that we have for the audience while we have you here. And we don't expect these to be answered in order necessarily, but she might put these out there, and as she is, have people think about them and respond as they can.
So yes, opening up the audience, these questions for our audience. Firstly, we're wondering if your organizations or communities have implemented any strategies or outreach mechanisms designed to draw immigrant communities into national service programs. Our research thus far demonstrates that this community not only holds a strong value commitment to civic engagement, but also that they dedicate an enormous amount of time to engaging in it in various capacities and roles. And how can we better tap into this vast set of resources? And this being said, we're also in the midst of quite a significant shift in the U.S. political climate, and we'd also like to hear your thoughts about any changes that could result with regards to immigrant populations' commitment to civic engagement in light of these changes. Lastly, we're interested in how AmeriCorps may have influenced your members' professional trajectories. Do people who have been involved with AmeriCorps continue to work in jobs related to civic engagement? And while we're interested in hearing from you on these questions, the work we've done thus far will continue to inform the questions that guide our further research as we move further. These areas of inquiry include analysis of the relationship between city and civic engagement, the cultures of civic engagement and social network building, strategies that, that immigrants bring with them as they enter the U.S. context and develop while they're here, and the role that institutions play in the formation of pathways of civic engagement and professional success for immigrant populations.
Great. So how about you put it to the previous slide so people can do the questions? And so, Jill, can you open it up, please, for Q&A?
Absolutely. If you would like to ask a question on the phone line, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone line and please record your name when prompted to be introduced to ask your question. Once again, it is star 1 at this time. Please stand by for questions.
So we do have one question that has come through the chat, or at least one comment that has come through the chat, someone responding directly to the questions that you all have posed. So that we've tried to connect with the Hmong Cultural Center and the Spanish Community Center. In particular, there are liaisons in the public schools and at the local university. So there are folks who are doing exactly as the research findings have suggested in trying to do this outreach and bringing immigrants together in these spaces, in the public schools and other public institution places who are currently listening.
Can I ask just a question, and they can respond, or somebody else? I'm assuming that some of these folks in the field have done this very form of outreach with other institutions and organizations that serve immigrant populations. And if anybody wanted to remark on the relative success of that, I would be interested to hear.
So you should feel free to ask questions of the presentation or just be able to answer some of these questions.
Yeah. I have one question. I was wondering if you asked any questions in the interview and through your protocol that sort of connect with their experience this year with kind of past potential civic activities, you know, in their countries of origin. And any patterns, if you see any patterns emerging, or is that sort of like a real shift?
So we did ask that question in the interviews for them to just sort of talk about their involvement in their communities pre-migration and then their involvement in their communities broadly post-migration. And we do find, I mean, this one of the research questions that we're moving forward with is that folks bring with them a distinct set of activities and skills and dispositions from before their migration, and so we haven't quite coded that yet, but we do think that is meaningful. And we certainly have found that some folks come with either having not done a lot of civic engagement because there was not the organizational support to enable it in their home country, and that partly inspired their civic engagement here, or bringing with them a rich past of civic engagement. And a few cases we found that, because we have this motivation for civic engagement as one of the codes that we've identified, that in the case of the younger folks who migrated very early, that their parents were often very civically engaged, so that they came as young children, but that their parents brought with them a particular spirit of volunteerism or civic engagement that they then either caught or had a sense of obligation to, like, pay it forward. So do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, so India was an interesting example. Not only Raj, but several others that we interviewed who had come from India. There was a strong value commitment to community engagement. It's just what you do. You're expected to do that. But it doesn't translate so easy as I was trying to point out in that earlier example in some cases, because there are cultural differences in the way communities are organized that allow for that civic engagement to be carried out. So while we see maybe a value commitment, maybe different motives, sometimes it is to further careers, especially at earlier points in people's careers. But there does seem to be a desire to be engaged and for our subjects from India. And in, I think, cases from Eastern Europe in particular, we also see this same assumption that that's just what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the interesting thing for us in terms of these barriers when they are expressing these value commitments is to see not only the barrier itself, but how they're understanding that in light of the way things worked for them in the past. And so we were trying to draw this out in a lot of our questions as well. So as Amy says, we've still got more to do in terms of systematically finding patterns there linked to specific cultures, but we feel very strongly that that's important.
If I could just add on to what John's saying, so some of it's about the structure of the network that exists in these countries prior to migration. And so in the case of India, I mean, I know we talked about that sort of the network structure as being sort of an extended family model of community support and community participation. And then in the Eastern European model, it was often actually what we would call weak ties. But there was an implicit understanding that it was that things were gained through networks, and so that was just a strategy that you engaged, often serving folks in the process, but then there were also sort of some personal gains. So there's something about network structures as well that we haven't quite untangled, but we're hoping to move in that direction.
Excuse me, we do have some questions on the phone if you would like to take them.
Yes, please.
Okay, our first one is from Judith. Judith, your line is open.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this presentation. What it sets up in my mind is similarities or differences. People born in this country, either multiple generations ago or the first generation of the children of immigrants, and how did their professional interests and civic engagement develop, and any differences depending on whether they're U.S.-born or recent immigrants? You may not have studied that in this particular project, but I assume you would be familiar with any literature on similar questions or other groups of people in this country. Thanks.
So thank you for that question, Judith. We are largely, that wasn't initially a question that we had worked through all of our transcripts, but some of this comes out in the answers that are provided. So I can draw even on that earlier example of Raj again comes immediately to mind because she talked about how her children don't really care that much about volunteering and being physically engaged. They've grown up here in the United States. They see their mother doing all kinds of volunteering, but they do live with her, and she takes great pride in that. In India, if your oldest son, for instance, is still living with you, that's a good thing, and he feels a little differently about it, but he knows he can do that and save money on his not paying rent, He's very smart and has learned, I guess he's become kind of an expert in social media. And now he goes around to all of his friends, barbers, people at, who work on his car. He doesn't have to pay for anything. He doesn't buy any of his own meals. He barters. So he gets free haircuts. They get free social media. Eventually, though, his mother, who still wanted him to be, you know, engaged in volunteering somehow, started to introduce him, knowing his interests, started introducing him to people she was working with, and he started doing the social media stuff for all their organizations. And he was doing that voluntarily, wasn't being paid. He felt like, okay, make his mother happy. So sometimes they still do get engaged, and he likes it now, and he now he, she says he's actually starting to, you know, consider doing much more of this on his own. So, you know, that's just an anecdote. We don't know how much to make of these little bits that come out, Judith, but I think it's a great question, and I would be curious to see if somehow coming to the United States that's blunted. I raised this example because I don't think it has to be. I don't know if that fully answers your question. As to the broader literature, I'm not sure that I've seen many studies on that particular point, though. There's obviously a huge literature on second-generation migrants and their transnational identity. And we have seen, especially in cases of Mexican immigrants here, who have been able to sustain transnational identities in second and even third generations, like migrants from Oaxaca, for instance. Historians would say that kind of an identity typically is typical of first-generation immigrants, but it disappears in the second generation. And part of the argument has been that since the 90s or so, 80s or 90s, the nature of globalization, or at least our self-awareness of it and our new cheaper technologies and transportation have made more possible the sustaining of these transnational identities in second and third generation. So that's about all I can say to that.
Our next question is from Linda Chavez. Your line is open. Ms. Chavez, are you on mute? Your line is open.
Thank you. I am in Senior Corps, so our audience is a little bit different than what AmeriCorps would have. And part of the issue that we're having, and I don't know if you saw this, but in Los Angeles, there's 242 languages spoken, and we have a number of insulated groups, particularly the Asian communities, Chinese, Korean, and it's very hard to break into those communities because we don't have marketing materials to break into those communities. So in your research, did you find that sometimes it's just our inability to be able to do outreach into those groups? And that's what's preventing us from having, I mean, because we're already very diverse here. But I think we could have more if we were able to reach to them.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So among all of our interviews were conducted in English, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of our participants are fluent in English. They certainly identified the role of language as being meaningful both to their own professional trajectory, but also sort of the community's trajectory. So I think that that's quite right. One of the things that we did notice, though, is among the population who were doing civic work for either immigrant groups or organizations that were just, so for example, polling stations. I'm just thinking about one of the participants. So she provided Chinese translation at the polling station, and we had a few other instances like that where you had these sort of multicultural straddlers, is what the literature would call them, and so that they have competencies both in terms of the sort of the cultural toolkit of their original language community, and then also the cultural toolkit and linguistic toolkit of the sort of more mainstream U.S. And so they are important straddlers for both. I would imagine outreach efforts, but we were actually thinking about how these folks have developed a particular kind of like immigrant capital that they have that they can use for civic ends that mm-hmm. both benefit the communities from which they come, but also sort of the broader sort of fabric. So to me, I would say that those multicultural straddlers are sort of are really important nodal points. But I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
And the second part to my question, real quick, especially in the Asian community, I've read quite a number of studies on it, they don't tend to volunteer. They tend to either take care of another family member or you work. Are you finding that through your interviews that the Asian community is less likely to volunteer?
Well, if you include India as part of your Asian community, I think most of our examples would say no.
Well, Indians do, but the Chinese and the Koreans specifically.
Yeah, that's what you're saying, Chinese and Korean in particular.
I mean, it's hard for us to draw any broad conclusions based upon the qualitative data. I mean, we've got 70 cases, and so I would be reluctant to say that, you know, a population that maybe we had a sample of, I don't know, 10 Chinese. So I'd be reluctant to draw any broad conclusions there. I don't know if the quantitative data can speak to that.
Yeah, it can. We haven't looked at it, but I think that would be an interesting question, and particularly to break out the Indians and Pakistanis versus the Southeast Asians, you know, for differences in Chinese.
Okay.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Catherine. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. So I work with a refugee AmeriCorps program, and so we come out of a partnership with ORR and CNCS, and so our AmeriCorps program kind of came out of a want to give refugees and immigrants an opportunity to give back, like that population in particular, to give back through to their communities through national service. And so, you know, when we are asking individuals, what are your motivations to become an AmeriCorps member, they run the whole gambit of giving back to their community. They're interested in refugee resettlement, particularly, you know, a wide range. But when it comes time to use their education award, even those who have master's degrees, international law degrees, are tending to, when asked what they actually do with it, I don't know. But when asked how they're going to use their Siegel education award, the answer is always future education. And so I was wondering if you could speak to this trend that I'm seeing at all, and if you have seen any motivations for national service or any service in general as, you know, either helping current educational endeavors or shaping future educational endeavors. This would be really, any information about this is helpful just in kind of how we want to target the program in the future.
So just a clarification for the GMU group, if you serve in AmeriCorps, you get a education award that then you can use towards, so it depends on, I don't know the details, AmeriCorps membership.
Either future education or loan repayment.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay. So we didn't have anybody in our sample who participated in any national service programs, so they would not have benefited from this loan repayment program or sort of the use of credit. I mean, two things that may be relevant, and the team may have something else to say. I mean, we certainly did have in our samples cases of folks who had come over as refugees, and there's two that come to mind for me, one who had been, sought exile and had been a journalist in Iran and had to leave because of her professional work and had been instrumental in starting a sort of a workstation for journalists in exile, and ended up going back to school. She ended up going back to school and getting a master's in immigration studies, which I thought was very interesting. So there is sort of that point, and which I mean I think connects professional work and
civic work. And then, but the other thing that is that may be related to this, but I'm not quite sure, was we did have a subset of participants who were very clear to disconnect civic engagement from professional work because it seemed somehow having crossed that moral line, that the idea that they could be, you would use your professional skills, but you would somehow benefit from it was sort of like a moral breach of some kind, and then so that they only did volunteer work that didn't relate at all to their education, their skills, or their professional work. But I'm not quite sure that's quite answering your question.
But I think it's interesting, you know, that the fact that there were no participants in national service programs on their sample, that perhaps this education advantage or loan repayment could be seen as an incentive to motivate people to participate in a way to sort of draw people in from this group of immigrant professionals into the national service programs.
Yeah.
I would also make an observation here comparing the United States and Mexico. So in Mexico, in order to graduate from most of the largest universities there, there is a social service requirement built into your degree. So it encourages that kind of, the very kind of volunteerism that we're trying to encourage CNCS in this country. It's not just about creating an incentive but letting you pay for some of your school. It's you do not graduate unless you have served. And so those who are working on developing a social enterprise sector in Mexico now have been flocking to the schools to build into these courses opportunities for internships and things like that in a variety of social problem-solving activities. So the British Council just came out with a report on this, for instance, and they're starting to see this increasing connection between institutions of higher education in Mexico and this growing social enterprise sector. So it does raise questions about how we're how committed we are to volunteer, how serious are we about having everybody as citizens participate in some way, engage in some way as citizens through volunteer.
The other thing that I would just say that was, just striking to us, although, the people that we interviewed didn't actually remark on it so much, was, so here's a population who are doing actually quite a bit of community-based work, community participation. They're mostly doing it for free, and they were variously placed on their movement toward citizenship. And we are a society that doesn't, we don't really count that in any kind of formal way towards citizenship. And I'm just thinking about how the ways in which if civic engagement were somehow to count as part, like as a point system toward citizenship, that could be a sort of another interesting pathway. Can you have something to say too about
that? Yeah, I just wanted to raise the theme of credential transfer as well when we talk about education awards. So we have many, many cases and individuals we talked to who came to the U.S. with a degree from their country of origin that was not recognized because they were unable to get a transcript that was sealed or signed in the correct way that the university would recognize it. So I think about the education awards both as an opportunity for people who really do need to start from scratch educationally, and also maybe even is there a way to make that less of like a barrier for people coming to the U.S.? Is there, you know, a way to build on the education they already have rather than that education award having to go all the way back to like the bachelor's level? So those are just some questions that raised for me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that was one of the original motivations for the survey, was thinking about what kind of credentialing could be done as quickly as possible. And, you know, one of the new initiatives we're starting at the Institute this summer is looking at how community colleges can play into that, and to sort of do the Made in America stamp that becomes important for education credentials and success.
Before we take our last question, just a reminder, press *1 and record your name if you do wish to ask a question. Our question comes from Caitlin Manzano. Your line is open.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for this presentation. I'll definitely use this in my work. I don't have a question per se, but I did want to provide some insight on the first couple audience questions that were proposed. I am with the organization Public Allies, and we're an AmeriCorps program across the country, and recently we just launched a VISTA component, which is Welcoming Community Corps. So we have VISTA members placed in city offices to ensure that city services are economically, socially, civically engaging immigrants. So that's one way that we are tapping into this population and engaging this population. We do have some immigrants serving with us. We have a couple green card members as well. And I think that to the second point of how can we tap into this resource of time, what I'm really excited about tracking is seeing how we can use a year of VISTA service to really convene an immigrant community. So, hopefully that would be an immigrant serving, but if it is not, what are the resources and spaces that we're providing to launch conversations within that community? And then finally, I'll just say to the question number three around expect to see changes in immigrants' commitment to civic engagement, I think, if I can be frank, the answer is yes. We have, just in the short turnaround of sort of the inception of this idea and then launching it, have seen changes in those who have been applying, those who have applied to serve and then changed their mind. I think that specifically the specific change in administration, so from the previous administration that was maybe allowing immigrants to feel more welcome and passing policy to do so, to this current administration that has a very different rhetoric. That's something, that's something that we're going to be tracking closely and are really interested in engaging thought partners around what do we do about this and what is our role in ensuring that immigrants still feel welcome and supported.
Great. Yeah. So do you mind sending your contact information to us? And we'll pass it on to George Mason.
And actually, to
sure.
that, and I know we're coming up to the end. Is there a contact info slide
oh, yeah.
for you guys?
Yeah.
Just to make sure that.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Also,
oh, yeah. That would make it easier.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
there we
yeah.
go.
Okay. Yeah. So we can be, you can contact us. Do you see
Great.
That?
Thank you, Caden.
Yeah, thank you. The group from George Mason could stay longer to just have brainstorm or think about things more concretely, but I know that people are busy. So, are there any more questions from online?
We have no more questions, ma'am.
Okay, so we're going to sign off online, and if people want to stay a little longer and ask more specific questions, we'll do that here at CNCS. So thank you, everyone, and the next one will be in July, although we do not know the date. And I think we're going to focus specifically on Senior Corps and the research we've done around that. So thank you.
Thank you.
That does conclude today's conference call. We thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect and have a great rest of your day.